Good evening. Welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash, and later on Building Bridges,
Mimi interviews Chile's new president-elect, Michelle Bachelet. But first,
now, nursing against the odds. How healthcare cost-cutting, media stereotypes, and medical hubris undermine nurses and patient care, with Suzanne Gordon. The nursing profession lacks many things, like decent working conditions, recognition, and respect on the job. We have a major shortage of nurses, and many RNs are dropping out of healthcare's largest profession. Suzanne Gordon examines how healthcare cost-cutting and hospital restructuring undermine the working conditions necessary for quality care. I just wanted to begin with a rather staggering figure. There are presumed to be a shortage of 126,000 nurses, or 12% of RN capacity. What are the implications of this nursing shortage for the health and comfort of an individual patient?
Well, it's the health and life and comfort of an individual patient, because what the implications are that if someone is sick in a hospital today, depending on the state or the place or the hospital, the nurse that there is taking care of them may have 8 or 10 or 12 patients or even more. And if they get into a crisis situation, the nurse can't anticipate that, prevent that, and act to save their life or to prevent very serious complications. And if things are bad today, and just as the baby boomers are entering, you know, they're going to be entering their 70s and 80s and 90s, there's an expected shortfall of anywhere from 500,000 to 700,000 nurses if things don't change, and pretty quick.
So if there's a shortage of nurses, the pay and working conditions of nurses, according to the market economy, should increase, and that should take care of it, right?
Yeah, but healthcare isn't a market, and it actually hasn't happened in nursing. Wages for nurses have stagnated, even though over the past, I guess, about 6 or 7 years, there's been increasingly a recognition of the shortage. What we're seeing is kind of spotty attempts to rectify problems, and a lot of mixed signals being sent by the hospital industry, by the media, by a lot of different groups. So you'll find that in a hospital, some hospital will be offering nurses to come from another country or another state or another hospital a sign-on bonus of $5,000, maybe even $10,000. But when the nurses who've been in the hospital for a long time and have proved their loyalty want to bargain for a new contract where they get better wages and working conditions, the hospital won't give it to them. So what you end up having is this kind of fragmented response on the part of the industry.
One of the things that I remember when I was a kid was always, and I lived near Clara Barton School of Nursing. It was a high school, and tons of people were going into nursing. It was such of great interest within working class communities and so on as a career.
Right.
So it continues, of course, to be a challenging career, but why precisely have conditions worsened so much in this last period of time? What is going on?
So, you know, the thing is that when I was a girl, which I'm 59, when you were a girl, you know, there weren't as many occupational options open to women. And as occupational options have opened to women and minorities, nursing is not something, you know, that people will go into because they can't become a doctor. It's difficult for them to become a doctor or something like that. And the same is true of minorities. So what we're seeing is we're seeing women's roles change. And, you know, if hospitals treated nurses like a cheap disposable labor force, if docs treated them like handmaidens, and if the media basically ignored them, if women had fewer options, or if there was a really, really bad economy, you know, nursing was always a kind of a good choice because other opportunities weren't available. But if you have more employment opportunities for women and more employment opportunities in general, then people are going to go where there's more money, more prestige, and where people treat you better. And the reality is that nurses are treated very, very poorly, particularly in the places we need them the most, because the patients are the most vulnerable, in hospitals and home care and nursing homes and rehabilitation hospitals. A nurse today might be taking care of 8, 10, 15 patients. The average nurse no longer works an 8-hour shift. She may work 12-hour shifts. In fact, the workload is so bad that nurses, now a new study came out and showed that most nurses can't even get their work done in 12-hour shifts. They donate a couple extra hours to the hospital to get their work done. And you know, kids go into nursing or they hear about this from friends who are nurses or family members, and they think twice about it.
We talk about a healthcare crisis in this country. We don't do anything about it. We, from what you're saying, there's a nurses' crisis in the country also. What can we do about it?
Well, there's a lot that we can do about it. I mean, one of the things that really needs to be done and soon is to get Hollywood off its anti-nurse kick.
Wait a minute. What do you mean?
Well, Hollywood is a major contributor to the nursing crisis because it really depicts nurses on doctor shows that are very popular. It depicts nurses in really dreadful ways. I mean, ER was a pioneer in what I call the new Hollywood PC, which is that for women and minorities, you can be a doctor, you can be a lawyer. If Hollywood wants to broadcast class and status and ambition and success, the character is invariably a lawyer or a doctor, but you're not allowed to be a nurse and be smart. You have to be a doctor wannabe, or the messages are really negative. I mean, we saw that on ER, where both the nurse characters over the 10-year span of the show were, one of them, Carol Hathaway, the one that was, you know, a couple years back and the longest-running one, she always had this kind of self-esteem crisis, and she solved it by going to taking the medical school boards and proving that she could pass them well. And then the last one, the last nurse character, Abby Lockhart, actually became a doctor.
Right.
And, I mean, this new show that's on TV now called Grey's Anatomy is positively anti-nursing. I mean, docs say things like, I hate nurses, they put nurses down. The only good nursing character that's appeared in the past four episodes is a nurse that was on last night who was dying of pancreatic cancer. She no longer worked in the hospital, but she had worked there. So it seems like the message that they're giving us is the only good nurse is a dead nurse.
What about the staff-patient ratio that's causing so much controversy in California?
Well, I think that there has to be regulation of the nursing workload. I mean, it's fairly standard in some other areas, like in childcare, fire trucks. The airlines have so many passengers per flight attendant. And to regulate the workload and ease the burden for nurses and make things safer for patients, they passed a safe staffing bill in California that would have guaranteed, when it was finally implemented, that in 2004 on a medical surgical floor, which is the biggest, those are the most floors on a hospital, nurses wouldn't have to take care of more than six patients, and in 2005 it was supposed to go down to one nurse couldn't be asked to take care of more than five patients. Governor Schwarzenegger decided that he would reprise his role as Terminator, and he decided to, by executive fiat, terminate or suspend the phasing of the 1-to-5 ratios. The California Nurses Association, which is a very active union and had lobbied for the bill for close to 10 years, they took him to court and the judge ruled in their favor. So now the ratio is 1-to-5 on medical surgical floors. And, you know, the California nurses have really showed the underbelly or the underside of Schwarzenegger that a lot of people didn't recognize was there for some reason. And he's been really, really nasty to these nurses. I mean, he said some pretty nasty things like, I kick their butts every day, he boasted very proudly. This is in the middle of a catastrophic nursing shortage. You have politicians saying stuff like that about nursing. This is not a really good message to be giving to the public.
How has managed care actually affected the nursing profession? And then also I'm going to tie another question in, which is the relative lack of unionization in that profession. I don't quite get that either.
Well, managed care, or what I call mangled care, really said...
How appropriate, how painfully, no puns intended, yeah. Appropriate.
Mangled care really set the stage, because for the kind of layoffs that happened in the mid to 90s, because when the insurers start cracking down on costs, the hospitals hired these high-priced consultants to come in and tell them how they could save money. And the consultants sold them this idea that the hospitals could restructure by essentially restructuring a lot of nurses out of jobs. You know, they said they could restructure the nursing workload so you'd have fewer nurses and you'd hire people who were less educated and, of course, then would be paid less. And this started this flood of layoffs and work overload, and they imported all kinds of processes that consultants had used in industry, you know, like in making cars. So they brought in this just-in-time staffing. So a lot of hospitals today, I call them cold-running nurses, they will have you'll go to work, and, you know, you'll drive, you know, whatever, half an hour, you'll get to work, care of, let's say, 10 patients or 7 patients. Then the patient census will go down. A bunch of patients will be discharged. If nobody else is admitted, they'll tell you to go home. Or you're planning to come into work, you know, tomorrow, and the patient census is down, so they'll tell you not to come into work, and you'll have to take a personal day or a vacation day. Now, really, I mean, this is supposed to be professional work. Why would anybody sign on when you can't even have a predictable work schedule? This is a terrible disincentive. And then, of course, if there's suddenly an influx of patients, the manager starts scrambling around and asking nurses, begging nurses to come in. And sometimes they even, you know, make nurses hang around by the phone. Like, they have to be on a beeper or by the phone. And, you know, and again, you know, if the faucet is off, they have to stay there. And if the faucet goes on, quick, 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 get in. It creates a very chaotic work environment and no permanent and fixed work schedule for the nurse. It's not something that makes people want to go into the profession.
So the nurses need more unions?
I think nurses need a lot more collective action like unions. I mean, in most countries where nurses have done well, where they have better conditions and better pay, it's because they're highly unionized. And that's true in the states. If you have a state like New York State or Massachusetts or California where more unionization, they've gotten better legislation, protective legislation. They have higher salaries. But, you know, people in the U.S. are a bit batty about unions. And they think, a lot of nurses think it's, quote, unprofessional, unquote, to be in a union because, God forbid, you should be like a truck driver. I mean, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was in radio, I was in AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, and I loved having that better paycheck and that health plan.
Well, we have a minute and a half left. Would a single-payer health system help?
Some sort of national, tax-funded national health system would absolutely help, because right now we are wasting about half of our health care dollars. That's about a half of almost $2 trillion. On profit advertising and marketing for all these health plans and hospitals and CEO salaries. We're wasting a lot of money paying the highest prices for prescription drugs of any country in the world, subsidizing the profits of the pharmaceutical industry. There's a lot of unnecessary, very costly toxic care that's given to people, and there's a lot of fraud and abuse. If we could liberate that money, it would be a necessary but, in my view, insufficient condition to start solving some of the problems, because we could afford to give nurses better pay. We could afford to have more nurses on the floors and in various institutions, have more nurse practitioners and so forth. And, you know, that would be the first step, because if you're wasting all this money, there's just not going to be enough money for nursing care. And we need nursing care, because nursing care isn't a matter of TLC. It's a matter of life and death.
Well, I would like to encourage our listeners to get Nursing Against the Odds, How Healthcare Cost-Cutting, Media Stereotypes, and Medical Hubris Undermine Nurses and Patient Care. And Barbara Ehrenreich said it beautifully. This is a skilled reporter, a brilliant analyst, and steadfast advocate. And the nursing profession needs people like you. The unionization movement needs it, and all of us who need a better healthcare system absolutely need people like Suzanne Gordon. So get Nursing Against the Odds, an extraordinary, important book by Suzanne Gordon, and it is published by Cornell. And it's been very nice speaking with you, and we'll have to have you back again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Suzanne Gordon.
Yo no canto por cantar. ni por tener buen amor. Canto porque la guitarra.
Chile's newly elected president, socialist Michelle Bachelet, she and her mother both survived torture under the Pinochet regime in the 1970s. Her father, a prominent general, was tortured to death in 1974. Bachelet previously served as the country's Minister of Health. Dr. Bachelet has stated, "One reason women have begun to appear as relevant figures is that we represent a type of humanization of politics closer to how people see themselves." The Global Labor Institute of the Cornell School of Industrial Labor Relations hosts a reception for Dr. Bachelet. And now let's hear from Dr. Michelle Bachelet, introduced by AFL-CIO International Affairs Assistant Director, responsible for the Federation's relations with Latin America and the Caribbean.
Good evening to all our sisters and brothers in the New York labor movement. Muy buenas noches a todos y a todas. President John Sweeney indicated to me yesterday that he wanted the personal greeting to be extended to our guest of honor on behalf of the 13 million working men and women which the AFL-CIO represents. Dr. Michelle Bachelet is one of our friends. Sister Bachelet has indeed been a friend in terms of her entire life and the life of her family, and particularly of her father, and particularly of her mother, actually have represented actually a continuing legacy for social justice. To paraphrase the words of Martin Luther King, I think that we're seeing that the arc of justice is bending towards Chile in a number of ways. It started to bend towards Chile in the 1988 plebiscite when the no to Pinochet prevailed. And it's been bending further, and very, very recently, with President Lagos declaring all the reports should be opened with regard to victims of torture and murder. And we see the arc of justice bending further in it, that it looks as if General Pinochet is finally going to be standing trial, which we certainly hope so. We see the arc of justice bending towards Chile insofar as the center-to-left candidates prevailed in the municipal elections in Chile. And we see the arc of justice bending towards Chile when we look at Sister Bachelet. So this is all very, very encouraging. What I would consider to be the eje de bien, or actually the axis of good in Latin America. But it is precisely by looking at our good friend and brother, Lula, in Brazil, that the Néstor Kirchner government in Argentina and the victory of Tabaré Vázquez in Uruguay is further evidence of this axis of good continuing. And the victory of Dr. Bachelet, this axis of good will be all the more reinforced.
Entonces, compañera Bachelet, le deseamos a usted realmente todo el éxito. Y sí se puede.
Sister and brothers, I'm very happy to be here. We Chileans have, I could say, an historical depth with the labor movement of the United States, because you were by our side in the very difficult moment of our history. We did have a lot of solidarity and support from you, and we know that and we don't forget it. But we also had a lot of support in order that President Lagos, who is the current president of our country, could be elected, trying to build a country that has a more profound democracy, that has economical growth, so we could, those benefits, be part of a better being and life for everyone of our country. But we will still continue working in order to be the first female president of the republic, but not only because that would be also a historical issue, but more important because even though Chile, as you may know, has been doing pretty well, is a democracy well consolidated. The civilian and military relationship has been, I would say, normalized. And I'm very proud to say I play a role in that too. And we have people living better than so many years, but we still have a lot of challenges. And some of our challenges are how we can deal with all the inequalities that our society still have. We have a dismal income distribution in our country. We have gender inequalities. We have inequalities between the city and the rural areas and so on. So because we have been having a lot of achievements, it is ethically, socially, and politically indispensable that we can make a better life for all the Chileans. So my program will be, in that sense, how we can help all the people, all the workers, to have a quality of life, the one they deserve. And that means that we want to build a just country, a more caring country, a country that everybody feels that it belongs to them, a country where the workers' rights are respected, where they can have they are part of a movement and they are also integrated part of the country. And in that sense, all the programs, the ideas that we want to develop, of course they're not easy. We will receive a big struggle against that because of the kind of things we want to do. Because I am a woman, and that is also very complicated in a machist country like mine. But I have to say, I have to pass a commercial. I not only was the first Minister of Defense in Chile, I was the first Minister of Defense in the region, because even the best developed countries in the region has never had a woman in this kind of works and tasks. So I know I have a lot of challenges, but we have the force, we have the right, and we have your help. So thank you very much.
Dr. Bushelet, interestingly, was a former Secretary of Defense, albeit under the government of Ricardo Lagos, but she was also imprisoned by, and her father, a member of the Allende government, was tortured to death by members of the coup of General Augusto Pinochet. She discusses her response to Pinochet and the issue of reparations for his victims.
Because of my history, my biography, because of what I have to live, that we have to solve correctly our problem from the past, but not with silence, with truth and justice, but also with reparation. That's why when I was the Minister of Defense, I had no problem to work with that. Many people ask me, how could you work with the militaries with your history? But on the contrary, because of my history, because I'm sure that my history doesn't intend me to go into revenge. On the contrary, I want to help build a country where we can all look at our eyes, we can all walk tall with dignity, and that where we can democratize our society so different opinions are not a threat, are seen as more a way to make our society more rich, more open-minded, I would say. And in that sense, I would tell you, when I work with the militaries, I try to do many things. One of them is to normalize the relationship between the civil and military group. Second of all, what I would like is a Chile that integrates all the Chileans through reparation to all the people who suffer. We have passed some laws, but they're still in the Congress, so we can give the dignity of all the people who suffer. And also we have a historic and political reparation because all these people have been recognized. I mean, everybody knows today in the country what really happened, and that's important in order to have a moral reparation. And on the other hand, there are some more economic reparations who have been discussing right now in the parliament. We should try to build a society where everybody respects each other, even though we think different. We have different ways of thinking how we solve the inequalities of our society, but we are all citizens with right and with the right to organize ourselves, trying to achieve the kind of society that we all dream.
Dr. Bushelet addresses the economic disparity and distribution of wealth amongst the Chilean people.
You know, Chile has been growing pretty well. It's a democracy. It's stable politically, economically. In that sense, I would say it's going well. But of course, if you look to the income distribution, it's very bad. It's dismal. And we need to improve that. It's not easy, you know. I've been studying how you can change that, how you can produce social mobility. And the answer that you find everywhere is education, education, education. And in that sense, education will be my priority anyway. And education from the very beginning of their life, because inequality starts from birth in our country. A child who is born in a poor house don't have the same alternative that somebody who is born in the house of professionals, of clinicians, people with cultural level, with education, with employment. So I will try to do a very good educational program so everybody will have the opportunities of their life. But also, I think we should continue and with stronger social policies that will compensate through good health programs, good educational programs, housing programs, welfare programs that will improve the quality of the life of all the Chileans. And I'll continue seeking and looking for answers in order what else we can do to improve this income distribution. One important issue is how we can increase the participation of women in the labor force. Today is very low, only 35%. That's too slow. We have to decrease the poverty. We have decreased it in this government to the half. It was, I mean, the three governments of the Concertación. In the 90s was 40%, now it's 18%, but still unacceptable. So we have to see a lot of different policies to see how we can decrease poverty and make more equal and more just conditions of life in Chile.
Dr. Bouchelet comments on the financing of the army by revenue from the Chilean copper mines and discusses what her administration would do about royalties from the foreign exploitation of the copper resources.
The money who goes from the copper mines to the army, the same that is the part of the budget will go there because the needs of the defense are much more than the copper law gives. So really the issue is not if the money comes from copper or not. The issue is to discuss what we need in defense, how much money that it costs, and it could come from copper or it could come from the budget, but anyway, it will have to come from somewhere. So that's not an issue today, an important issue. And also, because the commodity is so high, that lots of the money of the copper are not going to the armed force, they are going for social issues, and that's very important. On the other hand, we have decided that we have to put a royalty to the copper minings, because people have been investing there, but are not paying any royalty, and they are paying it all over the world, but not in Chile. And we needed that, because this copper in some moment will finish and it's not a renewable resource, and we need to spend that money in more development and research so we can help our industry, because when copper is finished, what are we going to do? We have to be able to produce other kinds of products, develop other kinds of the industry so our country can continue existing.
You've been listening to Dr. Michelle Bachelet, Chile's new president-elect.
This has been Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special.